world's window, ruminations and theonotic and otherwise, being an account of the author's travels in the New World. Preface. Growing up suburban in the veritable heart of Reagan America often has the flavor of that bowl of oatmeal that you eat every morning. On its own, oatmeal isn't much to write home about. Some people even prefer their oatmeal plain. Add a little psilocybin, a pinch of DMT, a dab of LSD, and a veritable cornucopia of 2C Special G flavored research chemicals, and that bowl of oatmeal suddenly transforms into what Pink Floyd called Alan's psychedelic breakfast. For me, however, the journey into the center of the visionary potential of the human nervous system, that very same journey out of the mundane world of war-bloated American consciousness, begins and ends with a humble coprophilic, shit-loving fungus with many a drug tale along the way. In terms of background, I, like many entheonauts, come from an unlikely world. My mother, an oil heiress, was classically unstable in the borderline sense. Her presence, likewise sporadic across the yawning chasm of my childhood memories, formed the basis of a particular set of imprints that have been a focus of my young adult life. Nevertheless, and in spite of her instability, she was a remarkable woman. Her second husband expressed it most beautifully and snidely, commenting at her funeral, "She was everyone's friend, wasn't she?" An off-color reference to affairs she certainly had during their marriage. Still, she was quick to laugh, ready to love when actually present, infinitely generous, and forgave without thought as to transgressions against her personality or her person. In my own life, I have emulated the example of her heart while transmuting the prima materia of her failings. My father, on the other hand, talk about prima materia, remains a man wholly devoted to the straight and narrow mythology of Reagan America, or what the patron saint of misinformation, Rush Limbaugh, errantly refers to as, quote, principled conservatism. Though I can't precisely tell you what principled conservatism actually is, I do believe it involves a combination of constipation, indigestion, and general bloat. My father suffered, and unfortunately still suffers, from all of the above. Shortly after 9/11, in response to an email I sent containing a biting and brilliant political commentary on American military industrialism by MIT linguist and cognitive revolutionary Noam Chomsky, my paternal family showered me with a barrage of ad hominem character attacks with the ultimate aim of bringing me into the mold of principled conservatism. Like any well-meaning son, I made what effort I could to stomach the meal that had been laid on my table, but in the end opted for more nourishing fare. I remember the very first time I ingested psilocybin mushrooms. It was something of a benchmark, you might say. It changed my life. From the cusp of middle high school, with all of its awkward pubescent moments, like some morbid sociobiological testing ground for primate postures, during these awkward years, I spent a great deal of time in solitude, reaching out for those occasional instances of affect and gesticulatory reflection. Truly, and for all its pain and uncertainty, the human experience is indeed a beautiful one, especially when seen as an unfolding retrospection. The year I first imbibed of the sacred mushroom, I had developed a particular interest in the inspired musings of Baudelaire, Rimbaud, and the 19th century French hashish eaters. I mulled over Baudelaire's Flowers of Evil and fancied myself precocious, excepting for the fact that I wasn't a particularly popular young man. In the Flowers of Evil, I intuited the first and faint stirrings of an authentic complexio appositorum, ripe with mystery and the irrational vicissitudes of the heart. As an American Irishman of German descent, I lusted after things strange, the stranger the better. In Bodger's vision of the artificial paradise, my youthful fancy found wings and took flight. I would sit beneath trees and imagine I was the sole denizen of a moon-bound garden, arife with Bodger's flowers of evil. The centerpiece of this perfumed flower garden overflowed, as if some sort of alien and opalescent fountain, spilling out into the four causeways from the crux point at its center. Consequently, and unbeknownst to me at the time, the word for psychedelic sacrament in the Nahuatl language of the ancient Aztecs translates to mean flower. The mushroom became the centerpiece of my imaginal Eden in the years that followed. As one day, perusing books in the library, I came across the image of an Indian woman holding mushrooms out over smoke in her outstretched hands, eyes half closed in prayerful reflection. The image took on a life of its own in my imagination, and that life appeared larger than my own. Since that time, I have identified the image as one taken from Gordon Lawson's The Wondrous Mushroom, but to this day, the image in my mind's eye remains much larger than the one from Alan Richardson's photograph. For not only does everything appear expanded, but there's a light escaping off the top and convex lenticular surface of the saprophytic basidiocarp like stardust off a fish's back. Several years later, that very same lumen natura, or light of nature, shown clearly in the illustrations and photography that accompanied the Austin Eric psilocybin mushroom cultivation guide published pseudonymously by Terrence and Dennis McKenna. The image captured my attention in one resolute gesture of mystery that has very much been a guide to my soul ever since. In a cosmic adumbration of what psychedelic and literary pioneer Aldous Huxley termed gratuitous grace, later that very same day, I just so happened to be walking into the boys' locker room when a friend of mine ran into me coming the opposite direction and, reaching into his overcoat pocket, handed me a bag full of the very same genus of mushroom I had earlier seen as an image in the student library, the genus psilocybe. Over the years, the manifestation of the mushroom in my life as a guiding imagos of the sacred has uniformly been accompanied by what analytic psychologist Carl Jung has termed synchronicity. Synchronicity, an acausal principle of connection between disparate spatial and temporal events, finds its most apt mythological expression in the Greek figure Eros, winged god of ecstasy and the spontaneous product of the creative fusion of chaos and Gaia. Like the flowers of evil image, which equates the delicate beauty of a flower with a diabolical daemonia, two forces in seeming and impossible opposition to one another are brought into a state of inexorable fusion, what alchemists refer to as the coniunctionis. From this fusion erupts an irrational and transcendent other, which brings the entire system into a supraconscious, transcendent state. Synchronicity has always seemed to me to be the temporal sensing of this superconscious other, and has been observed to be prescient of the revelation of the mushroom spirit in its incarnation as other. Thank you. Introduction to the idea behind the term in theonautics, which is used in the title. It's less esoteric than it may seem. The basic idea is to provide a metaphor for that paradoxical state of mind where one is open to a profoundly novel and oftentimes disorienting world while maintaining a sense of personal direction. Where, in the words of Wade Davis, one, quote, need only spin the compass, end quote, to discover the world and our lives anew. Simultaneously, and on a personal note, the idea has been part of the development of a clear sense of orientation and direction in my own life and the lives of family and friends. In meeting this challenge, I have necessarily invoked a concept that over the years has been incredibly difficult to express in a form that does not tend to make people uncomfortable in some way. Based in a particular philosophy developed by the Greek thinker Democritus, whom I tend to credit with some of the most ancient thinking on which the atomic and molecular worldviews are based, this specific approach functions on the basic assumption that at our core is a certain atomistic kernel, seed, nut, or essence. The Greeks called it daemonia, an idea that was further developed by Jung in the hypothesis of the archetypes. While I'm aware that there are certain very reasonable objections to the idea of the daemonia, such as the Buddhist concept of anatman or not self. I've used this idea that is basically something to be able to write around. Basically, the idea is that we have a sort of extremely flexible and mutable blueprint or a calling to our lives. So forgive this one irrational indulgence on my part. Over the years, I've often heard various adumbrations of the direction question as it was being asked of experts and authorities in the field of psychedelic studies, be it chemistry or anthropology or the philosophy of psychedelics. For example, if I'm interested in psychedelics, what do I study? Or how do I integrate psychedelic insight into my daily life? Or what does the psychedelic experience imply in terms of this or that life experience? More obtusely, I think the psychedelic experience can tend to inculcate a particular short sort of shamanic or mystical worldview in certain individuals who maybe are inclined to think in that way. A worldview very much at odds with the status quo of the cultural climate in which most of us exist in the 21st century in the United States, in the Western world. In fact, I don't think the shamanic or mystical worldview is as unusual or as exotic as it tends to be viewed. I believe that aspects of the shamanic and mystical worldview are pragmatic, a function of brain chemistry, and likely the result of certain types of evolutionary pressures that were placed on our ancestors. University of Arizona anthropologist Wiseman expresses it quite simply in stating that shamanism and its various technologies and accoutrements allows larger numbers of people to come together and stably interact at the group level as opposed to sort of individual fitness. I believe shamanism has also served the function of providing a certain flexibility in terms of nascent family imprints that we develop during the infant stages of our life. I believe this flexibility, which is also really grounded in the brain and the nervous system's neoteny, has allowed the human species to occupy an incredibly broad array of ecological niches on this planet. Nevertheless, certain aspects of the shamanic worldview can be difficult to accept, such as the Navajo assertion that the four mountains of their native homeland are sacred, alive, and constitute a sort of space-time mandala or maternal matrix of their existence. So here we get closer to the whole issue of direction or gaining one's bearings, and all of those issues implied by the entheonotic metaphor. For the shamanic and mystical worldview tends to be full of these self-orienting motifs, sacred mountains, world trees, sacred calendars. I see these metaphors as being grounded in a specifically integrated mode of consciousness, the holistic, occasionally intuitive, insightful mode of consciousness that weaves seemingly disparate elements into a cohesive fabric. I don't really know if there's necessarily any truth in the conventional sense to these things, but I feel like I need a sense of wholeness in my life. Functionally, this mode of consciousness seems to bring people together towards some common purpose, such as singing or dancing together, behaviors that have obvious implications in terms of our fitness as a species. As an example of the sort of dilemma I'm trying to get at, let's give the Grimm's fairy tale of the spirit in the bottle a psychedelic twist. So, as the story goes, a young man becomes tired one day with the monotony of his father's metalsmithing, so escapes into the forest to discover his own metal and what he's made of. As he's wandering lost in the forest, a voice calls out from beneath a tree, "Help me, I'm buried beneath this tree. If you help, I'll give you a gift." To make a long story short, and under a process that's roughly alchemical, the young man tames the spirit in the bottle and is given a magical cloth with which he can heal any disease. So let's say in this case that the young man becomes lost in the forest, but instead of a voice beneath a tree, he hears a voice in a mushroom or a plant. You can see the dilemma here. You have an experience, and this experience is so completely central to who you are that you don't really have any choice but to entertain it seriously at some level as a real and living possibility. However, by taking this experience seriously and honestly scrutinizing all that it implies, you become the object of certain vitriol, not the least of which is you begin to question the very foundations of reality. Personally, I tend to find myself, and I think a lot of people do, in situations where you're becoming a little defensive over your basic value system. So I feel sometimes like I've lost my own way. I'm lost in the forest. That I'm part of a particular time and culture that seems very much lost to me, a particular time and culture that in a sense I'm trying to escape. And I suspect that I'm not alone in feeling this way. So this journal and what follows is something of an effort to gain my bearings, to give some direction to myself and maybe even family and friends. Tomorrow, this was written months ago now, I'm heading to the forest and I plan on getting lost. I plan on getting very high and taking it all to heart. In my life, I've known people and I've had friends who I have immense respect for. Hopefully some of them are listening. As people in my life who have managed to really speak to me from the heart. So you all are my compass, my ground, part of the solution to this dilemma that's inclusive of my personality and its dynamics, which can tend to be very impractical, while simultaneously being a little more on the practical side, a little more down to earth. So for what it's worth, and there's obviously no pressure to buy into any of this, let's start the journal. Cusco, Peru. The incessant hum and noise of Lima, a swarmy maelstrom of sprawl and velocity. Our one night in the city was restless. Landing in the earlier part of the evening, I felt myself a bit more relaxed and emotionally open than prior days, weeks, even months. On the heels of dreams the night prior to leaving Albuquerque, there was something in the undulate rhythm of it all, like toggling waves, the sensual gait of the Peruvian stewardesses, the oscillating current of the language. As I sat looking up in the open-air skylight of our hotel in Lima, listening to the pulse of the city, and in spite of being desperately tired, I felt comforted, a sense of being alive and on the cusp of something wonderful. For all the ugliness of Lima, flying into Cusco over the Andes was truly breathtaking. Stark mountainsides, lush and green, ascending to snow-capped peaks. Our arrival into Cusco was punctuated by extreme exhaustion and a vastly overpriced taxi ride from the airport. From the airport, we quickly proceeded to the San Blas district of the city on the far northern end of the valley, which is more of a cradle than a valley, really. Cusco itself is all charm, with narrow alleyways, paved with cobblestone, an open and elaborate drainage system, and small cultivated gardens discreetly tucked into each and every corner. Arriving quite early, and our room not yet prepared, we waited some time in the living area adjacent to the patio garden at our hostel. Our host quickly offered coca tea, my first exposure to the plant, which was much of the motivation in visiting this particular region of Peru and the Andes. The first cup induced a mild and expansive elevation of mood, sending us out into the city in spite of exhaustion and 3 days of travel with little to no sleep. Cusco is gorgeous and powerful in its own right, nestled into the hills of the high Andes, everything built with economy and on top of everything else, with the effect of receding terraces of terracotta roofing. Ascending any of the given hills of Cusco, the view across the valley is extraordinary, framed on either side by tightly knit brickwork in the Incan style, the valley stretching out below in a dark orange terracotta ocean of syncretic Incan colonial architecture and style. From San Blas, narrow streets descend steeply into the central municipal valley. At the center, the Plaza de Armas, consisting of a large church on the northern end of the square, with the stone plaza situated around a central park. Farther south and to the west, the bustling San Pedro Market was an education in botanical culture, with Erythroxylum's coca, Trichocereus pachinoi, and Banisteriopsis coppi being openly sold together with fruits and vegetables. Our first day, I bought coca together with a hard ball of limita and quickly returned to our room, which was ready by this time. Much of the first day, I chewed coca, and after several hours, fell into that lucid, wafting dream state of which many of us are familiar. I felt myself drifting gently down the valley on a sort of tumbling cloud of light, soaring above a receding crevasse that was like a flowing cradle, the horizon sinking below me and peering deeply into this infinite and spacious chasm. There's an unfathomable sense that this journey into the heart of the new world is a blessed one, and that somehow, in some way, I'm seeing through my mother's eyes. Who knows how long it lasted, but there was something profoundly reassuring about it, something that I can only describe as soothing to the soul. February 8, 2009, Cusco, Peru. Our first night was quite restless, with Brandy showing clear signs of altitude sickness, albeit of a mild variety. Nothing a few cups of coca didn't take care of. I dreamt of my brother and the regret of losing a close friend. In the dream, he's packing all of his things. I open his closet to help him pack and find my bookshelf inside of it, noticing three specific books: Unspoken Sermons in Thomas Wingfold by George MacDonald, and a third book, so worn in its binding as to be completely unrecognizable. I'm compelled to open the book and to sign it as a farewell gesture to my brother, placing particular emphasis on the last letter of my last name, a great and swooping E. Today, we visited Cariconcha, a window into the world of the Inca. Translated to mean court of gold, Cariconcha was the very axis of the city of Cusco, itself considered the navel of the Incan world. Here at Cariconcha, more than 4,000 priests are said to have lived. At its centerpiece, an immense golden disc, positioned so as to reflect the morning light off its surface into the main temple. While Cariconcha is today a sort of bizarre amalgam of archaeological curiosity and Catholic presence, the court remains a startling example of Incan stonework. Stonework that, when originally encountered by the Spanish, was proclaimed to be the, quote, product of demons, an assertion perhaps less fantastic than some of the speculation today, that it was made by extraterrestrial, or that they used plants that were capable of dissolving rock. In all likelihood, the actual explanation for the elegance of Incan stonework may be far more simple, far more noble and elegant than some of this more wild speculation. Wade Davis observed, quote, "To quarry the stone, the masons sought natural weakness in the rock, small fissures that could be widened by planting a wooden wedge and then soaking it in water. Once a block of stone broke free, it could be worked with harder rocks by a series of abrasive blows that in time would transform its surface. Experiments have shown that even without iron tools, a shapeless lump of andesite can be turned into a smooth cube in just 2 hours. Perhaps even more miraculous than extraterrestrial or magical explanations, the actual explanation for Incan stonework betrays an attitude towards stone that's almost impossible to comprehend. Mythologically, the Inca seemed to have viewed matter as living, dynamic, even divine. The transformation of matter thus seems to have been viewed as a service to the gods. Naturally, then, time has no meaning for a task in service of the divine, and such an attitude, when harnessed by a system of imperial governance, perhaps explains in part how the Inca were able to be so prolific in such a short period. This basic attitude towards matter seems common to many indigenous groups and is more generically expressed in the notion of the sanctity of land or the sanctity of the earth. At Cariconcha, 41 imaginary spokes are said to have radiated outwards, and beyond the horizon is determined by the stars, the sun, and the moon, connecting various communities in space within the cosmological framework of the land of the Inca. To this day, and in spite of the conquest, which on many levels was a conquest of the mind, one religious icon of the Inca still remains, the icon of the earth. Echoed in the Pachamama concept, I somehow sense that the earth is still viewed in some sense as sacred in this place.
Sí, pero es rico, bonito. Tiene aroma.
February 9th, 2009, Cusco, Peru. Last night I chewed coca all night long. As the sun rose, and looking out westward over the city, the following vision unfolded above the terracotta roofing. Outside the window, the grinning face of a masticating jaguar, vicious, chewing and chewing, staring deep into its eyes, all instinct and gut. An unsettled feeling grows as I identify with the carnivorous consciousness. Fixating then on the jaguar's face, my field of vision rolls over in a gyrating and serpentine fashion, and to the left of the jaguar, I see the face of a very old tree, brow ruffled and eyes closed in sleep. The unsettled feeling mounts, dripping with sweat and heart pounding, my mind echoing, must raise the dead, must raise the dead. And the bleary-eyed tree awakens. Rolling over again to the left, I then see a bird like a toucan, but with more of a downward hook to its bill, gaze cast downwards. Rolling over, there's a face like a man, a conquistadore, and his face is merging right to left with a face like an Andean native. Stern brow, their faces become one, that is then an owl and a feline, then a shaft of light rising from its feral brow, and a crescent over the top, shot through by a beam of light that becomes a sort of ascending thunderbird. Then rolling again to the left, there's a circle of women robed in light, faces veiled and witnessing something in their midst, something that is hidden from my view. To the farthest left of the sequence, I see an angel, wings spread outwards and behind, hands outstretched in front as if receiving whatever it is being witnessed in the circle. Then toggling all the way to the right, and the jaguar, chewing, vicious face. Then right to left, it looks like a tube or a horn of some sort. Then left to right, in the central piece of the tube, with the robed women, tree, conquistadore, Indian, owl, thunderbird, becomes smooth and faceless. And there's only the winged angel on the left, and the masticating jaguar on the far right. Left, then all the way right, and the jaguar turns, looking straight into my eyes with a vicious smile. Then a look like recognition and friendship, and dissolves into formless light. Then right to left, and the angel transforms into a blue bird with an immense and rainbow tail, and turning around, flies away just as the sun peeks over the mountains. I have no interpretation for this most peculiar message. Coca. Coca must certainly be one of the more fascinating plants of South America. A spectrum of domesticated plant varieties, almost surely derived from a common Bolivian ancestor, Erythroxylums, coca, and Nova Granitense, were considered one of the three sacred plants of the Inca, as well as yaque and manioc, sent by Huayracocha at the dawn of creation. Ubiquitously known as Mama Coca throughout the Andes, the status of coca amongst the peoples of Peru is aptly expressed in t-shirts and signs all throughout the Sacred Valley. Las hojas de la coca no es una droga, es cultura. The leaves of coca are not a drug, they are culture. As a barometer of Incan influence, the presence of coca forms a sort of cultural dyad of the continuity and extent of the Incan Empire. Where the Inca were, you today find both coca and corn. Though much of the existent patterns of coca use are hybrid forms of a more ancient pattern, there are certain groups which seem to maintain their relationship with coca in an ostensibly pure form. In the Kogi mythology, The cosmos is conceived auto-egocratically by the Great Mother, who anoints one of her pubic hairs with menstrual blood and then impregnates herself with a phallic-lined stick. As descendants of the ancient Tirona civilization, the chewing of coca is for the Kogi the purest activity of their lives, as well as the most profound expression of their culture. At the age of 18, and in preparation for marriage, the Kogi initiate are gifted the ritual implements for the chewing of coca, their yuburo, gourd, and lime stick, which are gifted by the shamans. They are also gifted a mochia, or coca bag, by their wives-to-be, woven from thread also gifted by the shamans. For the Kogi men, the first bittersweet taste of hayo, or coca, brings them into manhood. At the marriage ceremony, the shaman perforates the oburo and impregnates its bulbous base with lime. The shamans of the culture are divined at birth by the throwing of coca leaves, which are then read. If the neophyte is selected, they are then taken deep into the mountain and raised the first 18 years of their life without any exposure whatsoever to sunlight. At the age of 18, and on a particularly clear day, the shaman is then brought out into the sunlight and tastes hayo, or coca, for the first time. So you see, wrapped up in symbols of rebirth and the maternal matrix, the chewing of coca is, for the Kogi, the recreation and genesis of the cosmos as they know it. February 10th, 2009, Pisac, Peru. From an old poem, though the path before me stretches clearly, and long the winding road that leads me, each step I make hence follows surely, crux me stella, the crossroads are my star. That was written shortly after my Uncle Buster died while I was in San Francisco. We bussed earlier today from Cusco eastwards to the small Andean village to Pisac. The bus ascended perhaps 1,000 feet from Cusco, which is at 10,000 feet, and then descended 3,000 feet more to the Urubamba River Valley. On the bus ride, I was quickly engaged in broken Spanish by an elderly artisan from the Peruvian city at Huancayo. He pointed out the various animals, introduced me to his wife, and agreed that I should follow him into the market at Pisac to view his artwork. Little did I know that I would then be pretty much obligated to make a purchase, though I might have expected it, and it was beautiful nonetheless. Carved gourd with images of the sacred valley engraved upon it, decorated with images of the Inca and their valley, sun and moon, serpent, puma, and condor, some trinity of sacred totemic and Dayan animals, Machu Picchu, and scenes of traditional agricultural practice of the valley. As we descended into the Urubamba Valley, we saw for the first time the terrazas, the terraces of the Inca. The coca in Pisac seems better than Cusco, larger unbroken leaves, and the choco or corn is really a meal unto itself, so superior to the corn in the United States. February 11th, 2009, Ollantaytambo, Peru. A soft wind blows warmly up the crevasse perpendicular to the sacred valley where Ollantaytambo is situated. I think we will spend several days here, as I'm quite moved by the people and their pace of life. An even gentler wind blows through my soul this evening as we watch the sun set over this splendor of a valley. After our arrival by colectivo from Pisac via Urubamba, we made our way through labyrinthine chasms of stone and soil, skipping over drainage rivulets from off the mountain stream of the Montaña de Santa Marta. Gazing up the crevasse, eastwards up the valley of the Santa Marta mountain, an immense calm suffused my body and oft-weary heart. There is a sense of sacred space here, perhaps in the heart of the people. Who was it that wrote, "The soul of a place is its people"? I feel myself being drawn up the valley, drifting in a world of folk reveries and smiling faces, dark-skinned and hiking up the valley with ease. To be here is to feel human again.